This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Good afternoon. How's your Monday going? Good to be talking to you this afternoon here on the Country Hour. And shortly, taking a look at the big broadacre parcel of properties that's now on the market, Macquarie Bank putting its cropping business Lawson Grain on the market. Now, that's six properties here in Western Australia, four in New South Wales. It's a total of 105,000 hectares of country, and it's expected to fetch well over $500 million. And apparently the phone's been ringing hot and a lot of you are interested in getting your hands on, I don't know, one, two, three, I don't know, part of this property anyway. And a lot of interest from the WA farming sector. You'll hear more about that just before news headlines at 12:30. And also after the news and across to the Bureau of Meteorology, you are off to the Carnarvon Magistrates Court because proceedings got underway this morning in WA's big cattle stealing case. It's created a lot of interest. Two people have been charged with stealing just over 800 head of cattle worth about $800,000. Pilbara reporter James Liveris has been inside the Carnarvon Magistrates Court all morning, so you'll get all the details from him after 12:30. This is the Country Hour on ABC WA, 12:06. We're starting today with some reactions to Labor's historic victory in the WA election and what it all means for rural and regional parts of the state. First up, Pingelly farmer John Hassell, who's the new head of the ag lobby group WA Farmers, is looking forward to working with Mark McGowan's Labor government over the next 4 years. And that is interesting because it wasn't that long ago that John Hassell was the Nationals candidate for the seat of O'Connor at the federal election.
You know, our communities are made up of people from all different persuasions, and even though we might have a majority of one particular persuasion in an electorate, there's still important people in that electorate. And, you know, we've got to try and get the best results for everybody. And there are six sort of pillars that we're worried about and that we need to try and work with government on, and that includes carbon and water and roads and rail. And I think we've got to work with government on all those fronts. Plus, we've got quite a large election platform, which you may have seen prior to the election. You know, we need to work with government on all those things to try and get better results.
So where do you start now that the new government has been elected, John?
Well, we've got to find out who the minister's going to be for starters, and whoever that may be, I guess start trying to develop a relationship with them and trying to get them to understand that we're all on the same side, which is about getting better results for the agricultural industry. Because even though mining is, you know, so far out in front, agriculture is still the second most important industry in the state. And, you know, when agriculture flourishes, so does the whole state.
Do you think it will be a different kind of opposition if it is made up predominantly of National Party members?
I think just the very fact that it's going to be a small opposition is going to be very challenging for them. So they're all going to be very, very busy people. And, you know, if we can work with them and the incumbent government, that's what we'll do.
Do you think it has been a good outcome for farmers, this election, John?
Oh, I can only tell you that after we've had some success or not. You know, I hope that whoever becomes the Minister for Agriculture can see that it is a really important industry, fundamental to our state. The state does well when ag does well. Let's all work together to make the state better off.
WA Farmers President John Hassell, who took over the reins on Friday and says now that the state election has been run and won, his first priority is finding the lobby group a new home. Just who will be WA's new agriculture minister won't be known for, well, a couple of days. Mark McGowan says a caucus meeting is going to be held on Wednesday to appoint MPs to the new look ministry. So maybe later on Wednesday or into Thursday, all will be revealed, not only the ag minister, of course, but all the other portfolios. 12:09. Well, Steve Thomas is an Upper House Liberal member for the South West and was a regular here on the Country Hour during the last term of government as the opposition spokesperson for agriculture for the Liberal Party. He's shattered by the results of this state election and says the Liberal Party has to now move quickly to get back into the political debate.
Well, I think there was some expectation around the party room and the greater party that there would simply be a swing back, and you know it would never get worse than 2017 was an expression I heard quite frequently. The reality is that it got significantly worse. So there was just some expectation, but we didn't do enough, Nadia. We didn't have policies out there for discussion in the early part of this last term of government. I mean, for the first two and a half years, I don't think any policy was developed. Nobody heard from the Liberal Party about issues. And I have to say that we didn't make enough contact with the media and get things into the media. I mean, we needed to be ringing talkback shows like yours and when issues are raised and get involved and get on top of issues. And we didn't do enough of that. We weren't in contact with journalists at the major areas, and we weren't in contact with regional newspapers enough either. So all of those things meant that people thought the Liberal Party wasn't present and wasn't in the debate, and you cannot do that. So the job for the next 4 years with a third as many people as we had previously is to demonstrate that the Liberal Party is present and is in the debate.
Steve Thomas, who says he'll continue to be a spokesperson for agriculture and regional development, irrespective of which portfolios are handed out and by whom. Now, you would think that if the Nationals and the Liberals do form some sort of a partnership, you would think the Nationals would want agriculture. But regardless of that, Steve Thomas says he'll continue in that role he's had up until this point as being a spokesperson for agriculture here in WA. So I wonder what the Nationals think about that. Well, WA Nationals leader Mia Davies says the party will need to have a united front as it faces the very real possibility of becoming the official state opposition, with Labor's huge win reducing the WA Liberal Party to what could be just two seats. The Nationals may move into opposition. And one of the first concerns Mia Davies has with the new government is the possibility of upper house reform. Now, at the moment, a regional member of parliament's vote is worth three times more than a city member. In the lead up to the election, Mark McGowan insisted upper house reform was not on his agenda. But Mia Davies is not so sure.
I think the Premier's been very careful with his words in the lead up to the election. He's been asked multiple times by journalists like yourself whether or not it would be ruled out, and he's never once said, yes, I rule it out. It is not something that we will pursue. We do not support it. He's been very careful with his words, and so I do have great fears that we're going to see electoral reform that will reduce the number of people from regional Western Australia in the Parliament. Whether that's a National or a Liberal or a Labor Party member, I really at this point am not fussed. It's actually the fact that we will have less people who understand what it's like to work in regional WA, educate their kids in regional WA, access aged care, healthcare. I think that's a poor outcome for a state the size of Western Australia, with some unique challenges that vary from the Kimberley to the Goldfields to the Wheatbelt to the southwest, and then in the metropolitan area. And that's what that house, that Legislative Council, which is where we're talking about, was designed to provide some balance and some voices from every corner of a state the size of WA.
Mia Davies, who's the leader of the WA Nationals and possibly the official state opposition leader. Watch this space. 13 past 12. Warren Pearce is head of AMEC, the Association of Mining and Exploration Companies. He's a little bit worried about how much power Labor now has here in WA.
There's very little in the way of other parties or opposition opponents to hold the government to account. That means there's a very small group of people having to deal with a wide range of issues of legislation, regulations that need to go through the parliament that don't necessarily mean that all will get tested as well as they might otherwise. So that is a challenge. But ultimately, it's going to come down to how the government chooses to progress their agenda. And indeed, you'd have to think that they'll feel they have a particularly strong mandate from the people of WA to do so.
We do know in the lead up to the election, one of the promises was a package worth around, I think it was $35 to $36 million, looking at some of those streamlining processes, and especially when it came to applications and essentially fast-tracking some of those applications. It was an election promise. When do you expect to see some of those promises start to come through?
Well, pretty much immediately. I mean, the reality is simply doesn't require legislation to make those changes. It simply requires the government to fund the agencies to bring on more staff into those key approvals roles. That'll be the biggest investment into the Department of Mines probably in 15 years, and it comes at a time when it's really needed.
AMEC CEO Warren Pearce talking to Tara de Landgraft about one of Labor's pre-election promises, a $36 million boost to Western Australia's mining sector. Quarter past 12, ABC WA, this is the Country Hour. And the head of the Kimberley Pilbara Cattlemen's Association hopes the re-elected Labor government will reduce costs on pastoral leaseholders and reform land tenure regulations for all primary producers.
Currently, it's very expensive and a very long process to even do some irrigation, to put irrigation in and apply for the use of to use the land to grow crops and to grow fodder. And a lot of our people found that, again, that process very expensive, very long-winded, and a more constructive approach from, well, the bodies, instrumentalities of a government like the department would be much appreciated.
Luke Simpkins, he's the CEO of the Kimberley Pilbara Cattlemen's Association. And your thoughts, most welcome. What did you make of it? I guess not a surprise if you followed the polls predicting a Labor victory, but certainly an historic victory for the Labor Party here in WA. What do you make of it? What does it all mean for rural and regional Western Australia? You can text through and have your say, 0448 922 604. 16 past 12
on ABC Radio WA. You're with Belinda Barischetti for the WA Country Hour.
Not far away from checking in with the news headlines and then off to the Bureau of Meteorology. First up, though, as I mentioned a few moments ago, Macquarie Bank is putting its big cropping business, Lawson Grain, on the market. And word on the street is it could fetch well over $500 million. Now, Lawson Grain owns 105,000 hectares of country here in WA and over in New South Wales. Here in this state, Lawson's biggest aggregation is Hakea, which is near Munglinup, west of Esperance, which spans 12,730 hectares. Then there are properties at Dandaragan, Wongan Hills, Jeremungup and Jacup. In total, six properties in WA and four in New South Wales. Danny Thomas is director of the real estate agency and advisory firm Land Agribusiness Water Development, which is handling the sale. Danny, why is Lawson Grain on the market?
Oh, it's end of fund life, Belinda. So this is a 10-year fund and it's at the end of its fund life.
What were some of the other options on the table for Lawson at this point?
Oh, typically speaking, when you've got a closed-end fund like this, the options are to extend. That can be a bit complicated. Where you've got multiple investors, or you could do something like a listing on the ASX. Again, that's very complicated. I think the simplest way to deal with it is simply to realise the assets and send the money home. There's a really good story to tell you.
So just give it back to the shareholders?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Not reinvesting back into agriculture?
Oh, many of them probably will, yeah. But, you know, how they do that, whether that's direct or, you know, through a pooled fund again or a commingled fund, that'll be a matter for them. So, you know, the way things were done 10 years ago might be different to how they're done today.
Does the sale mean that Macquarie is not interested in agriculture anymore?
No, absolutely not. No, no. There's nothing sinister or anything else here. It's certainly not a failure. In fact, it's the opposite. It's a gross success. So what it really means is that, you know, they've achieved their goals. They've hit the end of their fund life and they're going to realise those gains and repatriate the money to the investors.
Now, you deal in the sale of some of the really big transactions in this country in the past. How does this one compare in size and scale that we're talking about, a broadacre parcel of land? How does it compare?
Yeah, look, this would be one of the best and one of the best ever. I think the Nicoletti deal over there in Western Australia would boot it for scale, but that would be, you know, in inferior rainfall areas in comparison to this. These are really sort of highly producing properties. They've had great capital works done to them. They're really starting to hit their zenith of production. There's still some more gains to be made, so people can still go there and do some more continuous improvement. But they've been benefited by really good stewardship over the last 10 years and some great development work and management, and they're really highly productive. So there's not many portfolios of this size and scale at this quality that have ever been offered to the market.
Can you just outline the properties and the hectares here in Western Australia? Because that is where the bulk of the properties are located, six in total here in WA.
Yeah, that's right. So there's about 60 to 70% of the total area of circa 100,000 hectares located in Western Australia. and that's across six aggregations, three in sort of the northern part of the Wheatbelt to the north and west of Perth, and three in the southeastern part of the Wheatbelt, sort of situated between Albany and Esperance. So they're all pretty high quality properties.
And then in New South Wales?
Yeah, four properties there. Again, you know, well distributed geographically and in terms of rainfall. So two in southern New South Wales, one in central New South Wales, and one in northern New South Wales.
Obviously, there's been a change, a massive change in seasonal conditions in the eastern states compared to, say, the last 3 or 4 years. How has the season panned out across the two states for Lawson Grain?
Good year, you know, across the board. And, you know, that goes to some of the story, I suppose. You know, they've finally achieved, you know, some of the potential of these places benefited by the coalescing of all of the great work they've done on, you know, soil amelioration, rehabilitation, better production techniques, and then, you know, struck a fantastic season on the east. Not a great season in the west necessarily, but just extraordinary results on the limited rainfall that was available.
Now, Danny, I've heard the figure of sort of a $500 million upwards possibly of that figure. Can you confirm that's the sort of ballpark that you're looking at?
Oh, yeah, no, we're well and truly eclipsed $500 million, Belinda, yeah.
So when you say well and truly, what does that mean?
It could be $550 to $600.
In terms of dollars and this parcel of land, is that some of the biggest price you've seen for this sort of broadacre properties?
Yeah, there's no doubt that the market's quite buoyant. And, you know, the drivers of most of that increase in value have tended to be the privateers, you know, the local farmers making generational decisions to make new investments. So they're the strongest driver of value in the market. And, you know, the institutions are going to have to compete with that if they want to hold a portfolio like this together.
Yeah, in just a moment, in fact, talking about the prices being paid for farmland in Australia, they're really at heady heights at the moment. One buyer shelling out $7,750 an acre for a broadacre property at Wimmera in Victoria. So that works out to be $19,150 a hectare. With that sort of figure upwards of, you know, well above $500 million, is that the sort of ballpark Lawson Grain properties are looking at?
No, they won't be those sorts of halcyon heights. That's the sale you're talking about is a relatively small parcel of land. You know, a lot of local competition from guys looking to do farm build-up, so you couldn't overlay that sort of level of value across, you know, 100,000 hectares. But, you know, that theme in the market that's running through the market means that we're going to get a great result here. You know, this will be highly competitive.
Where do you think the interest is going to come from for these properties?
Well, there's the institutions. So, you know, for a long time now, you've had a lot of international institutions and local ones for that matter saying that, you know, the deals aren't big enough in Australia. You know, if we want to go and deploy $500 million or $250 million in one go, you know, that's very hard to do. Well, come on down. Here's your opportunity. They can do that now. So we've got rid of that excuse. And then, you know, look, don't discount the locals in a little bit of a similar way to you saw, you know, four, you know, very strong private operators club together to come in with a late bid on the Kidman portfolio there a couple of years ago. Nothing would surprise me here. And I wouldn't be surprised if we saw, you know, a syndicate or syndicates formed to take things out either holus bolus or, you know, East Coast or West Coast or large aggregations within the portfolio as well.
So all of those options are on the table then as far as the preference for sale. It doesn't necessarily need to be sold as one lot. They're open to, you know, separate parcels.
Absolutely, yeah. So, look, you know, Utopia would be Lawson's and their fund manager feel that they've built a really good, you know, strategic portfolio. They've made a great investment in, you know, people and systems. They run a great business. They've got, you know, stable management workforce in place, and that's there for someone to step into. So Utopia would be to see all of that good work, you know, stewarded forward with a new investor. But equally, you know, all options are on the table. And so we absolutely welcome interest from locals. And in fact, it's our obligation, you know, to take that to the market and maximise the price. So all interest is welcome.
If there was just one buyer for this big parcel of land, that would have to be a corporate, would you say?
Well, I think it would be an institution. You know, it would be a pension fund, a super fund, a sovereign fund. It may be a high net worth, might be one of Australia's billionaires. And, you know, there's a plethora of them over there in WA. So it wouldn't surprise me if we got interest from groups like that.
But you think there's going to be interest coming through from just the local farmers? I mean, six properties here in Western Australia, you think the farming community here would be keen to have a look around?
Absolutely. You know, this was announced on Thursday last week, and I think the phone's scarcely been away from my ear ever since. And we've had the full gamut of that inquiry. And a lot of the local agents have been ringing us as well, you know, demonstrating that they've got clients that have been, you know, out of the market for a long time trying to find the right opportunity and looking for an opportunity to participate here.
Now, Macquarie also owns Viridis Ag, which owns 110,000 hectares of cropping land across Australia. Are there plans to sell Viridis properties also?
No, one's got nothing to do with the other, so they're completely separate independent funds. And Lawson Grains is a much older fund than the Viridis fund, so I don't anticipate any of those assets ever being put to the market in short time.
And, I mean, you know, you've done this many, many times, so how do you think it's going to unfold? What's the most likely scenario as far as the selling of the properties?
I've done it that many times, Belinda, that I can tell you right now I've got absolutely no idea. No agent would. I never cease to be surprised about who comes out of the woodwork for these things. And, you know, we as professionals obviously think that we've got a fair idea who's in the market and who's the most likely, but we're wrong about 50% of the time.
Danny, thank you so much for being part of the Country Hour today.
Good on you, Belinda. Thank you.
Danny Thomas, he's from Land Agribusiness Water Development, and he's handling that sale. Macquarie Bank putting its big cropping business, Lawson Grain, on the market. And what did Danny say? Could be sort of around the $600 million mark as a full parcel, 105,000 hectares across WA and New South Wales. 26 past 12, and just your reflections on the result of the WA election over the weekend and the historic win for the Labor Party. Salty Matt says, it's interesting that the increase in the National Party vote almost directly reflects the decrease in One Nation support. I would imagine that's concerning for the National Party, knowing they have One Nation supporters on board. This, yay for Mia Davies, as leader of opposition. At least now the Nationals have a voice to put the rural plight back on the agenda to be heard after being buried for the last 4 years. Some of those newly elected Labor pollies might be shocked to even know that anything exists on the other side of the Darling Scarp. Let's also hope for a new Minister for Agriculture. That minister should be known Wednesday sometime, maybe into Thursday. And this from Paul in Jeremunga. Read the election result. We now have a one-party state with a token opposition. One should reflect on the history of one-party states. It will be up to each electorate and citizen that they get fair representation and ensure the elected MLA represents them and not the Labor Party. That is, vote according to the electorate's needs, demands and requirements, not along party lines. After all, the MLA represents 100% of the electorate. Thank you, Paul in Jeremungup. Your thoughts most welcome between now and 1 o'clock on the text 0448 922 604. Just before the news headlines, there's been all kinds of records broken in Australia's beef industry this year, including the price for cattle getting exported to Indonesia. Feeder steers exported via the Darwin port have been getting around $4.30 a kilo this month, up 65% on where the price was in April last year. It's been great news for top-end cattle producers, but what pressure is it putting on Indonesia, which is now just 1 month out from the religious period of Ramadan, where demand for fresh Australian beef reaches its peak? It's a question Matt Brand put to Brooke Barkler, who works for a feedlotting company in Sumatra.
I think we're at peak season at the moment, so I think, you know, the reason why we've seen $4.30 is due to lack of supply and a smaller herd, which has been driven by the ongoing drought. And, yeah, this has significantly impacted the Indonesian importers, our customers and the meat traders in Indonesia, as well as the Australian live exporters. The price in the herd, I think, has probably also impacted Australian producers here who might not have any cattle to sell, and who also might be trying to restock and can't afford that at the moment. The Australian dollar is also a pretty big factor at the moment. So that, along with the high cattle price and also pressure from the Indonesian government on the sale price, is definitely making margins sort of squeezed from both ends for importers at the moment.
Is it true some of the feedlots over there have gone bust?
Some feedlots are quite low in capacity and some haven't imported cattle for quite some time. However, I really think that once, you know, the season starts kicking off in April and May throughout the dry, that these feedlots will focus on restocking and getting their businesses going again. They've all got, you know, very large workforces to keep employed, probably big feed stocks on hand, lots of equipment, and, you know, really got to get the cash flow rolling. So, you know, I think we'll probably see a turnaround on that in the next few months. Overall, during Ramadan this year, I think, you know, we're probably going to have lower demand than we have in previous years due to, you know, the economy being a bit down and social restrictions happening. But I think, yeah, the demand will far exceed supply given the capacity at the moment in the feedlots. And the gap's probably going to be made up from local cattle.
So what's that going to mean to the price of beef in the wet markets?
I think that it will increase, Matt. But I think, you know, everybody's very conscious that the government wants to keep the meat price down for consumers. You know, so we're probably a little bit limited at the feedlot gate as well at what we can sell at to make sure that, you know, the meat traders can stay in business as well.
What's the risk of Australian cattle getting too expensive and then Indonesia looking to source stock from elsewhere?
I think that very much is dependent on the price in the next few months. In the long term, you know, as you might have heard, that Mexico is being discussed at the moment. Long term, Mexico is a very far distance from Indonesia compared to Australia. And I think there's probably some big challenges with freight costs on that as well. In the short term, I think it looks to be a viable option for them, but there's currently some challenges with ports and registered premises and licensing as well.
So you're not expecting to see any Mexican cattle arriving anytime soon?
I don't think so. I think it will take some time to work out those challenges.
Long term, if the price stays at around $4 a kilo, can everyone make money in the supply chain at that type of price?
I think that will become difficult and potentially, you know, Indonesia will look at getting cattle from somewhere else if it does stay at that price. But, you know, I think we'll see what happens with the season. The dry season's kicking off. At the moment, we are, you know, the highest price in the season. So I think we'll see what happens in the next few months.
And just in general, Brooke, how is Indonesia coping with the pandemic?
I think it's been really quite a tough year for everyone in Indonesia. It's a very liquid economy and, you know, people live day to day. So it's very hard for the government to impose restrictions and lockdowns like they have in Australia because, you know, that really impacts, you know, people's day-to-day lives and making a living and also the economy. The food and retail sector have been really hard hit and a lot of people have lost jobs. And places like Bali, you know, they completely rely on tourism. So I think they've really suffered as well. People are saying that Indonesia might have a slower recovery than some other countries in Southeast Asia, but economists are saying that, you know, there'll be 4-5% GDP growth this year. So I think that puts Indonesia in a pretty strong position.
Brooke Barkler, she's from the feedlotting company JJAA, and in an effort to keep those meat prices affordable for the Ramadan period, the Indonesian government has also issued permits to import an extra 80,000 tonnes of buffalo meat from India and 20,000 tonnes of beef from Brazil. This is the Country Hour. It's 26-1. Jonathan Beale is here with an update from the newsroom.
Thanks, Belinda. A WA Liberal politician says his party failed to be a credible opposition during the election campaign. Upper House MP Steve Thomas says the Liberals' energy policy was the stupidest policy the party's ever released. One of the only remaining lower house Liberal MPs, Libby Metem, says Mr Thomas makes some valid points. The ABC says it will defend itself over a defamation suit launched by lawyers on behalf of the Attorney-General Christian Porter. The action relates to an article reporting a letter had been sent to the Prime Minister containing serious allegations against a serving cabinet minister. Mr. Porter's lawyers say he was easily identifiable as the subject of the allegations and that the report made a number of false accusations. And a 40-year-old Perth woman accused of murdering her two young daughters is expected to apply for her trial to be heard by a judge sitting without a jury. Milka Jurasovic is arguing she was not of sound mind when the two girls died at the family's Madeley home in October 2019. Today, Ms. Jurasovic appeared in the Supreme Court via video link and officially pleaded not guilty. She's due to appear in court again in May. More news coming up, Belinda, at 1 o'clock.
Thank you so much for the update, Jonathan. 25 to 1. Shortly, heading off to Carnarvon, because at the Carnarvon Magistrates Court today, proceedings got underway in what is one of the biggest cattle stealing cases here in Western Australia. There's a lot of interest around this case. Two people have been charged with stealing over 800 head of cattle worth about $800,000. And we spoke to WA police here in the Country Hour, was it Friday? And Thursday it was, and the senior detective was saying that further arrests are imminent. So this is just the start of this particular case, but two people appearing in the Carnarvon Magistrates Court this morning, and ABC reporter James Liveris has been there for the session. You will hear all the details shortly here on the Country Hour. And of course, a wrap of the Mishay cattle market just before the news at one. Right now, it is off to the Bureau of Meteorology and Matt Bodehoven. How's it looking in northern and eastern parts?
Yeah, afternoon, Belinda. Over the next few days, the pattern shouldn't change too much. We've got a ridge of high pressure through central parts of the country and a surface trough from the Kimberley to waters off the Pilbara and then back over the western parts of the Pilbara. So showers and thunderstorms through the Kimberley, also coastal parts of the Pilbara and western parts of the Gascoyne and western parts of the Pilbara over the next 4 days. But by Friday, the showers and thunderstorms will be more confined to the eastern parts of the Pilbara, northern interior and the Kimberley. I've had some heavy falls through the Kimberley in the last 24 hours and we've got some flood watches and warnings out for the Kimberley. And over the next 24, 48 hours, we could see a couple of good heavy falls and maybe something up to around 100 millimetres.
All right, and further ahead then?
Further ahead, in the northern eastern parts, showers and thunderstorms will continue through the Kimberley over Saturday, Sunday and Monday, and maybe some shower and thunderstorm activity through the Eucla southern interior on Saturday and Sunday.
And moving into the southwest land division then, Matt, how's it looking?
Yeah, so the weather pattern's not going to change too much over the next 4 days. A ridge of high pressure will lie south of the state and a surface trough will linger near the west coast. So on Tuesday, maximum temperatures will increase through the southwest land division around 3 to 6 degrees. Might be a slight chance of a shower thunderstorm in the central west district. Then into Wednesday, again, very slight chance of a shower thunderstorm in the central west and the maximum temperatures rising 1 to 3 degrees. Thursday, Friday, fairly similar, well, more sunny conditions, no chance of a shower thunderstorm. Maximum temperatures mid-30s to the Great Southern, high and grading up to high 30s in the central west and nearly low 40s by Friday. So in summary, over the next 4 days, the weather pattern's not going to change much and we're going to see a warming trend.
And warnings this afternoon, anything to look out for?
We've got some strong winds. They're easing off now through the Pilbara coastal areas, but we've got some strong winds along the south coast from Cape Leeuwin to Islay Bay. Fire weather warning for the central west coastal north and some flood watches and warnings for the Kimberley.
Matt, thank you very much for that. 22 to 1. And as Matt was just saying, there have been some heavy falls in parts of the Kimberley. To go through those details is Richard Hudson.
Yeah, these are the rainfall figures in the 72 hours leading up to 9 a.m. this morning. In the Kimberley, Anna Plains 11 millimetres, Bedford Downs airstrip 52, Pidgeydanga 12, Billaluna 65, Broome at the airport had 17, Country Downs 96, Curtin Airport 32, Dampier Downs airstrip 24, Debisa 97, Derby Airport 22, Drysdale River Station 83, Ellenbrae 55, Fitzroy Crossing 33, Flora Valley 186, Fossil Downs 19, Gibb River 141, Halls Creek Airport 124, Jubilee Downs 38, Kachana 5, Kalumburu 21, Kilto Station 66, Kununurra's Airport had 20, and at the checkpoint at Kununurra 93, and in the township where at the Deep Herd Station actually 23. Lake Argyle Resort, 28, Leopold Downs, 76, Liveringa Station, 93, Margaret River Airstrip, 80, Marion Downs, 75, Mullabulla Airstrip, 36, Mount Amherst, 26, Mount House Airstrip, 73, Mount Krause, 28, Mount Winifred, 23, Morida had 28, Napier Downs 72, Nicholson had 141, Nita Downs 16, Old Mornington Homestead 118, Parry Creek Farm 7, Ruby Plains 103, Siddons Creek 139, and Sophie Downs had 17. So Matt Bodehoven mentioned the flood warning. DFIS have just issued a flood warning for people in the West Kimberley Rivers and Fitzroy River catchments, and you can understand why. A few more. Sturt Creek had 14, Theta 26, Truscott 7, Udiala 48, West Roebuck 11, Windjana Gorge 67, Windham Airport had 26, and Yulumbu had 23. So that's all in the Kimberley. A little bit in the Pilbara too. Carlindy 57, Sheila Plains 11, Glenflory Station 12, Indy 8, Carrageenie North 33, Marble Bar 6, Mount Florence 18, Mount Stewart 33, Newman 7, Pardoo Station 19, Port Hedland Airport 8, Red Hill 55, Sherlock 6, Telfer at the airport 10, Wailoo 8, Yaleene 23 and Yarri 34. In the Gascoyne region, Mount Clare, another welcome 23 mils. Mount Vernon, 13, and Turie Creek had 11. In the interior, Warburton Airfield recorded 10 mils. In the Goldfields, Laverton had the most with 4. In the Euclid District, Forest had 2, was the most. And out on the islands, Varanus Island had 8. And then in the Southwest Land Division forecast districts, nothing, no rainfall at all for the central west, lower west or southwest. In the southern coastal region, Munglin up west had 7, Oakmarsh Farm 8 and the Duke 5. And then in the central wheat belt, Gibb Rock, been on holidays I think, 15 mils over 8 days, Shackleton 8 and Tallenning Hill had 7. And then in the Great Southern region, I think Hyden topped with 3. A few other places had 1s and 2s, but yeah, most was Hyden with 3. That's it.
Richard, thank you for going through those details. It is 18 to 1. Shortly, just before the news at 1, off to Mouche and John Testro going through the results of today's cattle market. And speaking of cattle, Richard Arends and Rachel Third appeared in the Carnarvon Magistrates Court this morning. Both are charged with 6 counts of stealing cattle, 6 counts of property laundering, and 1 count of receiving. They're from Edmund Station, which is in Western Australia's Upper Gascoyne region, so about 250 kilometres northeast of Carnarvon. Pilbara rural reporter James Liveris is at the Carnarvon Court now. James, what did you hear this morning?
Righto, this case is over the theft and sale of 803 head of cattle valued at around $800,000. Now, it was revealed in court today that the bulk of these cattle were taken from an unknown property in Perth. Now, we're talking 500 head of cattle here, worth between $390,000 to $600,000. Now, the other thing Magistrate Potter said was, between the same day of the 1st of January to the 19th of December in 2020, about a quarter of the head of cattle was stolen from Mangaroon and Maroona Station. Now, they are owned by Thalangi Aboriginal Corporation, and they both border Edmund Station, where the co-accused are from. It was also alleged that 93 head of cattle were taken from Mardi Station.
All right, so Mardi Station, just a little background on that particular station. It's located about 100 kilometres southwest of Karratha, and it's on the coast. Mardi's owned by mining company Citic Pacific, which runs Sino Iron Ore. A few years ago, it was in severe drought. So in the middle of 2019, the manager, Richard Klimas, chose to sell all of the 4,000 Droughtmaster cattle on that station. He then left the property at the end of 2019. So, James, was any of that detail revealed in court this morning?
No, it wasn't. Magistrate Dean Potter simply just read out the charges.
All right. And was it mentioned in court today who actually owned the cattle that was allegedly stolen from Marty Station? Because I'm wondering if they were legally owned by CITIC Pacific or if they were tagged cattle that had just drifted onto Marty from neighbouring stations.
Yeah, it's a fair question, Belle, but no, it wasn't revealed who the cattle belonged to. However, what was revealed in court today was where the property relating to these offences were disposed of. Now, I'm quoting Magistrate Potter here. From the 25th of May to about 6th of August, property was disposed of in Karratha. Now, the other location was West Lines River in the Gascoyne region. That's where the charges were laid for disposing of property in relation to the offence, as well as the receiving charge.
How did Richard Arends and Rachel Third look in court today?
Yeah, look, I actually got to the courthouse at 8:30 a.m. for a 9:30 start, trying to get a jump on things. But Richard Arends and Rachel Third were already in the chambers, and they had a small group of supporters. My immediate impressions were they were very relaxed, sort of, you know, slouched over in the chair, not really bothered. You know, Richard is about 6'2", big burly New Zealander with an accent, a bit scruffy around the edges, and his partner Rachel, you know, sort of 5'10", slim and actually pregnant, carrying a baby. But basically, from there, the duty lawyer and representation of legal aid was called, which both individuals sought. Now, my understanding is from what I witnessed in the chambers, they were sort of unaware if they were going to receive outsourced legal representation. So, you know, quite relaxed about what was about to proceed.
So was there an outcome from this morning's proceedings?
Yes, the case has been adjourned till the 12th of April this year. Now, the co-accused applied for bail and they will remain in the Carnarvon area, hand in their passports, must not leave WA or be within 100 metres of an international airport. Now, again, I'm quoting Magistrate Potter here. Now, when that finishes, both will reappear on the 12th of April where they will make a plea.
There's been a lot of interest in this case in Carnarvon because Richard Arends is a contract chopper musterer who runs one of the two chopper businesses in Carnarvon, doesn't he?
Yeah, that's right. On top of running cattle, he operates A&A Services, one of the very few chopper mustering businesses in the region. Look, there is a lot of chatter and speculation. One thing that comes across to me is the importance of the Rural Crime Squad and just how vital they are to the pastoral community. Now, I've been here from Saturday. Obviously, I've been making calls in the last few months, but all the pastoralists are so proud of the job that the Rural Crime Squad are doing. And I guess they just want this case to set precedence so this doesn't happen again.
James, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for going through those details. James Liveris, the Pilbara Rural Reporter, just checking in with you this afternoon from the Carnarvon Magistrates Court, where Richard Arends and Rachel Third appeared in the Carnarvon Magistrates Court this morning, are both charged with 6 counts of stealing cattle, 6 counts of property laundering, and 1 count of receiving proceedings adjourned today. This is the Country Hour, and it is 12 to 1. In the last year, there has been a big growth in demand for plant-based meat substitute products sold here in Australia. That's the conclusion of a new report commissioned by Food Frontier, an independent think tank on alternative proteins. Thomas King is the chief executive of Food Frontier and says it looks like demand is expected to get stronger over the next decade.
Yeah, so this report is a state of the industry on Australia's plant-based meat sector. So we're talking about products like meat-free sausages and schnitzels. And the headline is that it grew exponentially from 2019 to 2020. We saw a doubling of manufacturing revenue and jobs. And that's in response to the growing demand from a third of Aussies who are limiting their meat consumption and seeking out more plant-based options. But who might still want the convenience and familiarity of a burger to throw on the barbecue or some mince for their bolognese.
Are we talking here about people who exclusively eat non-meat products, as in vegans, or is this people that are dabbling into this area, I suppose?
It's a combination, but what we typically see is that the majority of sales of these products are among meat-reducing consumers. So we know that a significant portion, about a third of Australians, are on that sort of meat reduction journey, whether that's for their heart health or for the climate. And the category growth in this space is being driven by those consumers. So there's different terms used. You know, meat reducers, flexitarians is thrown around sometimes. And that's in addition to those entirely meat-free consumers like vegetarians and vegans who also make up a portion of sales in this category.
Okay, so close to a doubling in sales, but also a big increase in the number of products and the number of brands available in Australia?
Absolutely. So, yeah, we've seen an almost doubling of Australian businesses producing these products and a real diversity of companies. So founders ranging from award-winning chefs to former FMCG executives, even family-run Australian meat businesses who are leveraging decades of expertise in producing conventional burgers and sausages and applying that to diversify into plant-based.
And there is also some modelling about what should be expected in terms of growth in this area in the next decade?
That's right. So Deloitte Access Economics projected three potential scenarios for the growth of plant-based meat alternatives in Australia. And the moderate scenario showed that this industry could be worth $3 billion in consumer sales by 2030, which would generate 6,000 jobs across the Australian economy. And that's the entire supply chain. So from, you know, sort of agriculture and ingredients all the way down to retail and food service. And that, yeah, signals significant opportunities for Australia in terms of jobs generation and agricultural opportunities. So plant protein is the base of most of these products. We know there are thousands of Aussie farmers producing protein-rich crops like legumes, and those are needed as ingredients for these products. So by us investing in building out that value chain, we can actually open up new markets for Australian farmers.
And there's also modelling suggesting that these sorts of trends are going to be replicated on a global scale?
That's right. So there are other Western developed markets that are further ahead than ours in terms of the size and scale of their meat alternative sectors. But the Asia Pacific is obviously Australia's biggest opportunity. You know, we're in the region home to more than half the world's population, and the region that represents the greatest portion of protein demand increase into coming decades. So we need to diversify our protein offerings in order to keep up with the fast evolving global protein market. And that can help Australia to meet our $100 billion goal of a food and fibre sector by 2030.
So I think Barclays is saying that by 2029, that plant-based meat substitutes could actually make up 10% of the global meat market?
Yeah, that's one projection. There are a number of market research agencies that are trying to crystal ball gaze to understand what portion of the protein market these sorts of alternatives could make up. The reality is it will be significant. We know that we can't rely solely on systems of livestock production to meet increasing protein demands globally. We'd need, you know, two planets worth of resources to try and do that. And so plant proteins, regardless of the particular percentage, will play a significant role in feeding the future. And Australia, by investing early and leveraging our strengths and capabilities now, can set ourselves up to be more globally competitive in that market.
Thomas, we're talking on the Country Hour. Lots of listeners are red meat producers, whether that be sheep or cattle. What should they make of this report and these projections that you're talking about?
Well, I think it's first important to acknowledge that the vast majority of Australia's food and agricultural product is exported. And so we're more reliant on international markets than we are our domestic market in most instances. More than 70% of our meat, our red meat, certainly gets exported. And so considering once again that we're in the Asia Pacific and it doesn't seem as though demand for our traditional protein offerings is going to decline anytime soon, I think this should be seen as a complementary opportunity and an opportunity for those farmers that are producing crops that can be valuated for these kinds of industries. At the moment, if you're a farmer in Australia producing, you know, legumes, for example, the chances are your product is going out into the global commodity market and not commanding a premium, despite the fact it's grown in Australia by Australian farmers using Australian best practice.
How about marketing and branding of some of these products? Because you are referring to them as plant-based meats, but even just that phrase is quite contentious.
Yeah, so most products within this category will use sort of a traditional, you know, well-understood term to speak to the format or the utility of the product. So in most instances, we see words like sausage or burger or schnitzel or nugget, along with a clear qualifier, like plant-based, like meat-free, like vegetarian, which speaks to the contents of the product. And by marketing it that way, it actually provides greater clarity to consumers who are navigating, you know, supermarket shelves to understand what the product's made of, but its intended use, you know, its utility. So just like we've got beef sausages and lamb sausages and pork sausages, now we have plant-based sausages. It should be really seen as an extension of the existing overall protein category.
Thomas King, he's the Chief Executive of Food Frontier. And just going through the details of that report with Angus Verley and how there's this big demand for plant-based meat substitute products sold in Australia. This is the Country Hour, 4 minutes to one.
Hello, I'm Rachel Mealy. Join me for The World Today. Fed up, angry and no longer going to accept it. Women across the country rally against violence. But despite his government's popularity suffering because of the issue, the Prime Minister refuses to address the marches. And how could they do it? UK police cause outrage by manhandling a group of women protesting against the murder of a woman, allegedly by a serving officer. The World Today, hope you can join us.
Not far away now, just after the news at 1 o'clock today. First, just got to squeeze in the market results because there was another strong cattle sale at the Mouchet sale yards this morning. 1,057 head were sold. So numbers down almost 500 on last week. John Testrow's been at the sale. And John, how high were the prices today?
Good afternoon, Belinda. The values for weaners gained 5 to 50 cents and today topped at 5.92 cents. And they were aided by strong feedlot local and New South Wales competition. The rain keeps coming over there and so does the demand. Yearling steers to the trade gained 30 to 50 cents on reduced supply. Grown steers gained 13 cents with grown heifers pretty well firm to 4 cents easier. The cow market improved. Medium weights up by 20 cents and the heavy prime were up by 10. And they sold to 3.40 cents a kilo. Heavy bulls to the processors gained 5 cents. But we'll just briefly some quick details. In the winter portion of the yarding, local winter steers to feeders sold from 4.10 to 5.92, up by 30 cents. Corresponding pastoral winter steers sold at 3.50 to 4.50, up by 5. Local winter heifers sold from 3.70 to 5.20, a rise of 10 cents. And the pastoral winter heifers remain firm and sold from 100 to 354 cents a kilo. Yearling steers, local to the trade, sold at 390 cents to 430 cents, up by 30 cents. Quality driven with very few penned. The pastoral's at 350 to 368, also gained 30 cents. Local yearling heifers to the trade, mainly grain supplementary fed, and they remain firm. They sold from 340 to 396 cents. Pastoral yearling heifers were also firm and sold from 250 to 388. Grown steers, 500 to 600 kilos. They were all local and sold from 388 to 398, up by 13 cents. Grown heifers firm to 4 cents easier at 346 to 398. In the cow market, medium weight score twos to feeders and restockers gained 20 cents. They sold from 266 to 326. Similar weights to processors sold from 198 to 304, also 20 cents dearer. Prime heavy to processors, they sold from 280 to 340 and gained 10 cents. Bulls, to round it all off, including pastoral, light to live exports sold from 396 to 496. They stayed pretty well firm. Medium weight range, 450 to 600. They sold to live export at 296 and were firm as well. But the prime heavy to processor sold from 286 to 318 and were up by 5 cents a kilo. But once again, a very good sale. And just a brief reminder, there'll be a big store sale at Boyne Up on Friday with around about 1,800 head to be offered. So one to watch with the numbers coming back quickly after that.
John, thank you so much for going through that. I appreciate that. We're back with you at Mouchet tomorrow for the results of the sheep market.
Okay, thanks very much, Belinda.
Thanks, John. John Testrow going through those details. And just a little sneak peek at tomorrow's show. Jason Craig is going to be here. Now, Jason is the head of marketing and trading with the CBH Group. And he's going to be talking about just how the grain market dynamics have completely been changed this time round. The season is just going off. There's demand from all sorts of new markets. Going through that with you tomorrow. News time, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.